I throw it down on the thing, and then it sort of decides to select something randomly.
Oh no. That's self-destruct.
Self-destruct.
The bus is going to explode in 5, 4, 3, yeah. Run!
In a world where pet dog owners are bombarded on all sides with well-meaning training solutions steeped in confusing jargon, two dog trainers from the ancient county of Dorset share a passion for gardening, Belgian shepherds, and helping frustrated and struggling dog owners turn their unruly canine companions into the perfect walking partner. They vow to simplify the dog training process using everyday examples and solutions, providing the light at the end of the tunnel. Welcome to the Fun Focus Play Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Fun Focus Play Podcast. And once again, we don't have Wendy because I have been doing a series of chats with dog trainers around the country. And today we are joined by the very brilliant and lovely Craig Ogilvie. Craig runs Craig Ogilvie Dog Training, and you're based, where was it again?
In Lincolnshire.
Lincolnshire, yes. So quite a way away from us. But we have the good fortune of having you down a couple of times a year to do some workshops for us, which is always really well received. And everybody who comes on those workshops really enjoy it. And they always tell me afterwards how pleased they were to get a chance to work with you, Guy. With
That's
you,
good
Craig. So, yeah, so we'll have to set up some more for next year.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, so today we are going to be talking about playing with your dog and why that is so important. And that's why I've asked Craig to come on with me, because Craig is the author of the Interactive Play Guide, which actually shows you and teaches you exactly how you should be playing with your dog. So without further ado, welcome Craig.
Hello everybody.
Tell us a little bit about yourself so that you're my listeners can sort of, and viewers can learn a little bit about you.
So with dogs, so my granddad was a police dog handler when I was a little boy. I grew up with him from when I was first born. So I always had, I was born into the dogs, if you like. In my late teens, I started to become more and more interested in the training of working dogs, which led to me traveling to Europe to study in a working sport called Mondio Ring. I then worked towards getting my decoys license in Mondio Ring, which is basically a certification which allows you to test the dogs in competition and train the dogs. So Mondio Ring consists of obedience, agility, and then criminal apprehension, like you would see in police dogs. So I was the first person from the UK to get that qualification, and I travelled extensively over Europe testing working dogs as part of our sport. Also, during that time, I was studying and teaching in different aspects of dog training. It was primarily behaviour focused at that point, and then my shift came a little bit more towards working dogs. Whilst I was working with dogs and sports dogs, my desire, obsession, if you want to call it, for play orientated activity started to build, because when you teach criminal apprehension, or the way that I teach criminal apprehension, which is the biting aspect of the sport, it's basically playing with a man in a big tug toy costume. And I could see how you could build confidence, how you could develop a relationship with the dogs and start to work towards training them and using that as an active reinforcer. I then spent a little bit more time in the UK and worked for the police full time as an instructor training the general purpose police dogs for Wiltshire Police, at which point I was delivering seminars over the country based on interactive play, problem behaviours, particularly problem behaviours in states of arousal, sports dog seminars, and other aspects of dog training. I had to leave the police because my business built up relatively quickly and I didn't have the time to do both, so I then went full-time and worked for myself delivering seminars, and I'm very, very lucky to have taught all over the world now. So I travel internationally every year to different countries, teaching and training mainly with dogs, focusing around interactive play, problem behaviors in states of arousal, sports and performance dogs, but they tend to be the dogs that I work with primarily.
Okay, well, thank you. I think that was a very, very brief.
It's a lot of information.
A lot in a very brief space of time. Yes, you have done a lot in your life so far.
Mm.
Much more than most dog trainers, I think. I think most dog trainers just come into it the way I came into it, which was, you know, I had a dog. He was chewing up the house when I left him. That then got me interested in the behavioural side of dog training. Then I decided that I did want to learn a little bit more. So I then did my COPE diploma. So I've been at it for about 25 years.
Yeah, God, that's a long time.
You know, but I sort of went into it, like you, quite naturally.
Yeah, yeah, I think
I'm my Sheltie. But then, yeah. You know,
I think that's a really
pet dogs.
that's a really common path, though. Like lots of the people that I work with have had a similar beginning in dog training, and it does. It's just different, isn't it? It's just a different introduction to it, really. It was only that the reason for Mondio Ring was because I was interested, yes, but unfortunately, the dog that I was competing with at the time and training got an autoimmune disease. So, as much as I was absolutely over the moon that he was going to survive and could stay with me, he wasn't able to continue with sports training. So, It was a little bit of a curse because I didn't want him to be ill, obviously, but he got better and he lived a really nice long life. But also it was a gift in the fact that it allowed me to focus primarily like on self-development and training dogs and really getting into the groove of working as a professional dog trainer. So, yeah, it's just a different introduction, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, it's sort of like a different way into it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about play because, like you say, you found that play was a really integral part of building that relationship with your dog. But what I'm seeing with pet dog owners who are the main people that I teach is that for them, play is just simply picking a ball up and just chucking it.
Which,
and having the dog run backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And while the dog enjoys that, I don't see that as being a very good way of playing with your dog. Because it's really easy to overdo things, but also it sort of brings the focus from the dog away from the owner.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm not a hard cast person with regards to I stand and die by the way you must do something. So I'm always very open and I want to see how people do different things. I'm open to lots of different perspectives. So with fetch, I very occasionally will play a tiny little bit of fetch for perhaps a couple of reps with my dog after an activity like a send away. So if he was to return to me after a send away, he'd loose one ball that he'd collected from the pickup point and he'd catch one off of me and I may throw another one just to stack like the reinforcement at the back end of that activity.
Yeah.
But the issue that there's many issues that can form with something like fetch. First of all, is that the obsessive component to the activity in its right. So the dog wants to chase a ball. The game very quickly becomes about chasing the ball. The reason that they'll often collect the ball and bring it back to you is because you're acting as a dispensing agent for the item. So you're going to throw the ball again.
Yeah.
Very often for those dogs, if it's me doing it, if it's you doing it, or if it's a drone machine in the corner, whereas we shape the dog to drop the ball on a push pad and it sucks it up and spits it back out again, the dog would continue to do said activity. So in my opinion, what that can do is take away some of the connectivity with the animal because you're not, there's nothing specific that you're doing, which may be wrong for some people. Maybe they introduce a slightly different version of fetch, which is completely doable. But for most people, I find from working with, you know, thousands of dogs, it's just the game of chucking the ball back and forth. So what I try to do is to bring a unique edge to the game in which the interaction relies on exactly that. It's the interaction with the handler. The toy just becomes a bridge for the activity. So the dog is playing and gripping onto an item, but it's really what the person does at that point when the dog is gripping onto the item, which tailors the interaction process to suit the dog as an individual. And for some dogs, we don't use the tugging style. Like you've seen me use lots of different styles of play to build confidence. So it's not necessarily that they have to bite onto a toy and tuggy with you. I'm very much a case that the dog, the individual, chooses the reinforcement strategy that we use because for them to find it reinforcing, it's exactly that. They must find the game reinforcing. So it's no good me saying, this Malinois plays like this, so I'm going to take this little dog that's just come over from Romania. He's really environmentally sensitive, worried in general about lots of different aspects of its life, and try to get it to do the same activity. Because it's very likely
not going to work.
Yeah, very, very likely it's not going to be the same thing. So you've got to have a step-by-step process to follow to ensure that that dog is able to take success.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's the obsessive component that I'm seeing is that, you know, yes, the dog is just a, you know, the owner is just a dispensing mechanism for the ball throwing. And that is the thing. So what I'm trying to do with my students is actually get them more interested in playing with their dog and engaging with their dog in play.
Yes, for sure.
And you know, maybe do a little bit of a tug and then throw that ball. And those little changes that just change that game from being just about chasing the ball to having the interaction with the owner, which then earns them the reward of chasing that ball, which is what they want to do.
And what I really try to do is I try to make the interaction with the owner or the interaction with their caregiver the thing that they're seeking. Because if you've got a dog that's got any desire or any pairing or time back to the predatory sequence, the desire for the dog to chase prey creatures, which is where much of the play that I introduce comes from, it's normally pretty easy to get that type of dog, depending on environmental influence, so the location that they're in, to chase and bite onto something. So
and it's those dogs that sort of go and chase after the birds when they land on the ground, isn't it?
That desire is there for them. And what I really try to do at that point is to tailor the process so that when the dog is interacting with the handler, they're tailoring it to suit that dog. So it's an individual process between them and the dog. And they're implementing all of the things that they know that the dog likes as an individual as part of the play process. So the game wouldn't necessarily, there's no reason that the fetch or the chasing for the ball can't be in like as part of that play process. But what we don't, for me, what I don't necessarily want is for the dog to come and spit the ball out at my feet and reverse back just for me to chuck the ball. But then if I activate it, as I call it, and explain for the dog to chase and bite with me, they're not so interested because the chase of the ball away from me is a little bit more reinforcing. I really try to tune that back into the handler so the handler is able to interact with the dog on a little bit more of a one-to-one basis.
Yeah, and I think that interaction, when you do get that interaction in play, it actually improves, you know, from my experience, the dog's behaviour when they're out on a walk as well, because they're not sort of constantly looking for something to chase.
And it's
because you know, what you've done is you've taken something that your dog has been quite obsessed about, i.e. chasing ball, to something which is more interactive with you, and therefore they're sort of looking more towards you to get what they want.
Yeah, and it's a sustainable outlet for the dog's desire to do something that comes naturally to them. So the breed of dog that I choose to have is the same as you, Belgian Shepherds. Yeah. I've got Malinois, like that is the breed that I spend lots of time working with. They usually come out of the womb wanting to chase things that move, that are usually prey creatures. So I don't want my dogs to chase prey creatures, but I'm not going to try to suppress their desire to chase. I transfer their desire to chase over to like a chaser toy with me, and then I build the game around me. And then eventually, to the point that I'm with my dog now, if he sees a bird or he sees a horse or he sees a sheep, what he does is goes, that's interesting, Dad's going to call me. And without a recall now, 99.9% out of the time, I get an auto-regulated check-in because he goes, oh, Dad's going to call me back. And he's reinforced for that by playing with me rather than chasing over the item, because I've just transferred the focus back to me. So it's a sustainable outlet for that activity.
Yeah. And just to show people what we kind of mean, so we've got I have got now for my Cassie, who is a Grenny, a really long tuggy with
a nice soft toy at the bottom.
A nice soft toy with squeaky. I'm not going to squeak it. No. We've got dogs in this room. Yeah. nicely lying down and relaxed.
Yeah.
But we just play with that now. So that's her reward now when we do our training, when we do our playing. That's what we play with. And she absolutely loves it.
And that's a lovely option.
She grabs onto it. It allows me to play a little bit of tug with her, and my hands are out of the way so they don't get bitten.
Yes, for sure. It's a really, really good option of toy. Really, really good option of toy, because it gives you the ability to get the same amount of chase as you would do with an item that you were throwing away from you, which is, so if we were to talk through the building blocks that I often use for play, Yeah. So chasing, the choice to chase, I call it. I always give the dog the choice to chase an item to begin with, so I can establish an understanding of the item that they might be drawn towards. So if you've got your dogs at home, which I'm sure all of you have that are listening, you'll notice that they are inclined, or they have that they favour items at home that they pick up. So you may have a toy box, and in that toy box, they may favour a particular type of material. It may be a soft, roadkilly type item, like Natasha just shown us. It may be a cage type ball. It may be a squeaky pig. It may be any of the above. Or it may be laundry out of the basket, or the tea towel off of the side.
I was just about to say tea towel.
They're all things that are information. So for lots of people, particularly tea towels and socks, they go, oh, God, that's a problem behaviour. The dog's stealing tea towels and socks. So if we were to manage their access to such tea towels and socks, which is relatively easy in most households, what we can then do is we can use an item of that material to start our play process with them. So the way that I would usually go about that is in a low distraction environment, like at home, usually in something like a corridor. So you're making the behavior easy to achieve. So we'd have a corridor and an open room. I wouldn't go with a room with like a bed on or a sofa or something similar, because often what the dogs will do is they'll like jump up on the sofa, play bounce to and fro, and it becomes a little bit messy. As well, if you've got a plain room or a corridor, you can take that item. So if we were using the toy that Natasha just showed us, that's got a squeak in the end. I particularly like a squeak because it's an easy, non-confrontational way to gain the dog's focus. Because what people do a lot in play is try to get the dog's focus by going to them. So they're going, "Oi, you, come on, let's play with this item," which is what I try to avoid at all costs. So if my dog was at the end of the corridor, you know, having a mooch around or chilling out, I could squeak the toy. What that usually does is the dog goes, "What's that going on over there?" As soon as that happens, what I'll do then is usually follow through with another tiny squeak. And as the dog makes the decision to come towards me, I'll throw the item in a little bit of a lurey type motion. I don't mean luring the dog with your hand. I just mean so that the dog sees the item and you throw it out ahead of you. What I'm then doing is giving the dog the choice to chase the item. So if they jump over to it, they may run over, pick it up, they may head shake it, or they may run over and sniff it. If they show a little bit of apprehension, what I'm not going to do then is pick it up and wiggle it towards them to try to get them to grip onto it. I'm going to pick it up, take another step away, give a little bit of a squeak. Look at my body language. I'm moving away. I'm not being confrontational with the dog. I'm moving on what I call the back foot. So the dog follows me again and I chuck it again. What happens normally over a short period of time is the dog will continue to chase, and you'll see arousal start to build chasing the item. Yeah. Which is
so the excitement gets higher and higher and higher because the dog says, "Oh, actually, this is quite fun."
Yeah, they want to. They want to chase the item. Oh my God, look what's going on. And then what normally happens then is that develops into the grab bite, which is part of the predatory sequence. So the dog will grab bite the item. Once we have that, we've got some of the building blocks in place to instigate the dog's focus and to get them initially chasing the item. So if you was working in a corridor, what we'd then do is I would generalize that process to a different room with a little bit more space. So it may be in the living room now, or it may be the dining room is usually best because we can just slide the table out of the way. So I'd follow the same process. But what I do now is I tie a bit of string somewhere around about 2.5 meters, maybe 3 meters, to the little roadkill toy at some. I usually tie it around the neck or around the end of the tail. And I play the chuck it game. Now, if your dog's a little bit sensitive to that long bit of string, all we would do is shorten it and make it slightly longer and longer and longer until the dog chases the item in the same way. Once we have that, then what we would do is as the dog lands and arrives at the item, rather than yanking it away or pulling it really furiously, all we do is just wiggle it along the floor, wiggle it along the floor. Yeah. What normally happens then is the dog does what I call the snow fox pounce. So they pounce onto the toy with their feet. And what I do then is I just pinch it away a tiny little bit more, tiny little bit more. What usually happens in one or two attempts is the dog then bites onto it. As the dog bites onto it, what I then do is create just a tiny little bit of what I call tactful toy tension. So two fingers on the bit of string, break my body silhouette so I'm facing away, and just get a little bit of tension. As soon as that tension occurs and the dog commits to gripping or maybe weight shifting or pulling back a little bit, I let the dog win the item, have a little bit of a hand clap, and then grab onto the item and start the game again. That becomes the foundation of the tuggy. And from that point there, we can then escalate the game and generalize the game to suit that dog as an individual. So it may be the case that very quickly we get into a little bit more of a vigorous type tuggy game with them, which for me always starts off with a nice side-by-side motion, moving side-by-side to keep a nice amount of tension on the toy.
Yeah.
And then we may know that our dog likes affection in this particular way. So they really enjoy smooth affection when you're at home with them. So what I would do is as we work our way closer and closer in this fluid tuggy type motion, I'd start off sharing affection with them, usually from just around about the shoulder down along the flanks or the side of their body.
Yeah.
If that's what they prefer. What I try to avoid people doing is it's coming over the top, head, because that often causes avoidance, conflict.
Yeah.
We want to make sure the dog's completely comfortable.
Yeah, they sort of pull their heads away when you try and do that, most dogs that I've seen. But it's always good to go for the shoulder and give them a little scratch on the shoulder,
that's dependent on the dog as an individual. This is where, like in all of the seminars that I deliver that revolve around play, I've done this with thousands of dogs, so I'm very lucky, and I can see patterns and spot patterns, and I can see what the dog likes and what they don't like. But from a caregiver, an owner, a guardian's point of view, that person knows the dog far better than me. So they know that when they get home from work, when nobody's looking, they fall down on their knees, roll about the floor, and do spider fingers along their back with the dog. And the dog finds that really reinforcing. So what I would do is I would take that aspect of the tactile affection that they share and then implement it into their game little by little. So this is what I mean about the toy is something for the dog to grip onto. The game that we're creating is a mixture of the tug and the tactile affection interaction that we share with the dog, which is going to be unique to every individual.
Yeah, and I think that really helps build that really strong bond with your dog as well.
Just
putting all those elements together because... you know, I've been on several workshops with you now, and I found that's really helped because one of the problems that I had with Cassie was that when she was young, even though I had her from birth because I bred her, because of circumstances, I was stuck with three puppies.
Mm-hmm.
So I was stuck with her and two others who didn't go until an older age. So by that time, even though I was taking her out and was trying to do all these bonding things with her, they didn't really work. She bonded with her brothers rather than with me. So,
bit of mate syndrome.
Yeah. And, you know, I really struggled, especially for the first year and a half, to actually get a really strong bond with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of trying to do it, through play. But, you know, when I came on when we did the first workshop, was it last year with you?
Yeah.
Just that one workshop just brought that bond on leaps and bounds.
Yes, for sure. And I think
you gave me the exact recipe that I needed to engage with her in play. Well, I had been sort of, you know, I had been playing with it, but obviously I hadn't quite got the whole idea behind how it actually worked until I came to the workshop. Actually made everything sort of fall into place for me. And it's just so much stronger.
All it is really, from my perspective, is experience and seeing lots of dogs, as I say.
Yeah.
And then usually it's just being able to sit from the outside and look in. And for me, from purely a behaviour perspective, say, this is what's going to work from this dog. And then really, apart from that information, which we get you doing nice and fluidly, then you make all of the tiny modifications that suit the dog as an individual. And it's really common, you know, if you've got three dogs from one litter, they're going to be, and they spend a lot of time together, they're going to become particularly bonded. Yeah. It's completely normal.
That's
exactly what you'd expect to happen. So all we do is, and I always say to people, like, divide and then conquer each goal as an individual. So you've got one dog that you're going to work with, what's going to work for this dog? And you'll probably find, even though they're from exactly the same gene pool, each of those dogs has some similarities, but then some things that they're completely different at, some things that they find completely differently with regards to reinforcement. And that's where I would say to people, even if you've got a group of dogs at home, one of the questions I get all of the time, people will message me at least a few times a day on one of the social media outlets and say, oh, I've got three or four dogs. I'm struggling to play with them all at once. And the problem being is you've got three or four dogs that spend a lot of time together. The interaction will very quickly become about them playing with each other if you're together in that social group. So if you take one of them and tailor the process to suit them, you stand yourself, you put yourself in much better chances to tailor the reinforcement process to suit them rather than it being a hit and miss type approach with a little bit with this dog, a little bit with
that dog. Yeah, and it's the same with any training that you do a dog. When you've got more than one dog, you want to take each dog out individually to do that training session with.
Yeah, for sure.
Rather than trying to do it with all the dogs out.
And it's the one-to-one connection. Like we've got five dogs at home, and one of them's mine, four of them are my partner's. But we all have a relatively equal share in all of the dogs. But when I take Zen out and train him, and when Zen come along as a puppy, much of that time is one-to-one, me and him, me and him, me and him. So there's no issue. Like, I've just been, before we did this podcast, over to our training barn to do some training. My partner was there with all of her dogs out doing different bits and pieces. And he's interested with regards to, what they're doing is exciting. But as soon as I say, ready, switch him on for work, the focus is on me, because all of the reinforcement structure is based around me, which I think is very important. You've got to have the ability to pay the dog for the behaviours that you'd like them to do. And reinforcement, for me, guides that. If you've got the reinforcers in place and you know that that is definitely what the dog finds reinforcing, rather than following a cookie dough cutter, this is what a dog should like type protocol, then all of the behaviours come that much easier.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, with Cassie, I've just found it. So I find that even when she's off lead now, she's just so much more focused on me rather than what's going on around her.
Yeah, for
just
sure.
Simply through doing that play training, it's just, you know, even though, you know, when you use treats, you do get the thing that, you know, your dog wants to do. You know what you want, because he wants to earn those rewards.
Yeah,
I want to earn that food. But once that tummy is full, that's it.
Yeah,
you lose their attention. But with play, you know, your dog. Well, it's a potential puppy, really, isn't it? When you look at it from a behavioral point of view, so they always want to play.
It's different. It's different for each dog as well. So. Yeah. Each dog that you work with will be different. I know a lot, and I've worked with lots and lots of dogs, that food in the hierarchy of reinforcers, so which reinforcers match at the top, and then we get like them coming down from one, two, three, four, etc. I know that for lots of the dogs that I've worked with, food is definitely at the top there. That's the thing that they enjoy.
Yeah, that's my Luna.
Yeah. So, but that's not to say that there's anything wrong with that. That's just the same as a human, you know, wanting to do, wanting to go running, or wanting to go out for a meal rather than to go running, So it's just trying to make sure that there is a version, and you don't have to even make sure. You could use food. You could theoretically use food to reinforce all of the behaviours. And I use it all of the time. It's an easy, sustainable reinforcer to use. But then your box becomes very closed, because it's, the food is all I've got. This is the only thing that I can use. And then you've not got a variety of reinforcers. So whether it's interactive toy play, tactile affection and play, if you're using something that the environment offers, sniffing, rolling in leaves, swimming, etc., they're all alternative options which expand your ability and your training capabilities. Because if you're out by the lake and the dog really enjoys swimming, it may be the best thing to do in that set of circumstances is, after they've done their hand touch or their check-in behaviour, you give them access to the lake. So, and if a dog doesn't want to play to begin with, that's okay as well.
Yeah.
Because it's not our job to get them to do something they don't want to do. For me, it's our job to make sure we tailor the process until they say, oh, I like that. That's the version of that game that I want. Food toys is something that you've seen me use lots and lots before. That builds up the dog's desire to chase, because of the pairing with like primary reinforcement, which is a biological reinforcer like food. So you put food in the center of an item of some type. The dog chases after the item and gets the food out of it. And that builds a dog's desires to chase. I've taught hundreds of dogs to tuggy through that method, because all of a sudden they go, oh, I like this chasing game, because it's paired with the food to begin with. And then you can start to fade the food out. So it's just about making sure, in my opinion, that you've got the options that suit the dog, and expanding as much on your reinforcers as possible, so that you've got different options to use and you're not just penciled down to one or two.
Yeah. And that is, I think that's where I was trying to get to, is that, you know, with some dogs, you know, you can use food, but once your dog's tummy is full, then it's really nice to have something else that you can use as a reward for the dog. Because if you don't, then, well, what are you going to do when the dog wants to go and chase something and you haven't got the food there because they're no longer interested in it?
Exactly right. But exactly.
If you've got a game that you can play with your dog, you know, a game of, you know, a tuggy that you could play with your dog that your dog likes, you know, you can call your dog off that chase and reward them with that instead of using that food.
What I would say to everybody
also want to, from a pet dog owner's perspective, they also want to not always have to carry food with them.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, they could just, you know, take a tuggy with them and play a game of tuggy instead as a reward for the dog doing something really awesome.
And what I would say to everybody is the reinforcement structure that you're going to use. So if you're going to use play, that needs to be generalized or incrementally taken to different environments, the same as any other behavior, because it's not fair by any stretch of the imagination to get this game in the living room and then perhaps expect it to occur in a park where there's lots of distraction. So once you've established the game or you and your dog's version of the game at home, then the next step would be in the garden perhaps, or in like the conservatory outdoors, and then to the garden, and then to like the village green that you visit on a regular basis.
Or if you've got a front garden, go from the back garden to the front garden, to the little grassy bit at the corner of your road.
Exactly,
just take it out and you just build on those distractions.
And then once it's stable and you are confident that the dog can play in the environments that you're going to visit, then that's when I would start to pair behaviours with it. But I wouldn't take those behaviours and do it in the park if we'd got all of the way up to the park. I'd then go back to the garden. And if I was going to pair my recall with play reinforcement, I'd do it in the back garden to begin with, make sure that we get consistency there, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Because otherwise, you build it up again, don't you? Because otherwise you might be missing a link, and then all of a sudden your dog can't do it because you haven't actually practiced it in an environment which is, you know, the jump is between environments is too big, basically, is what I'm saying. You have to sort of slowly build it up until your dog can play with you wherever you are. Yeah, so whether that is the beach or the forest or a big park or a field or whatever.
Yeah, I always say to people, set your target, set your goal. So like if you're going to use play, for example, for a recall, which is something that lots of people contact me about. So that is your target behavior, that you want to use your play as a reinforcer for your recall and to strengthen that behavior. And then you need to look at the location that is going to be the most difficult to achieve said behavior. So that may be the park when there's other dogs around. Yeah. And then we just need to reverse engineer that and take it all of the way back to the simplest environment and then incrementally build our way up to that location. So that and then if you hit a bumbling step, because it's never going to be a straightforward path, there's always going to be bumps, jumps in the road, all you do is take a little bit of a step back to the last incremental step, rather than if you've been getting it at home and you go to the park, as you just said, there's too much of a big gap in between.
And you know, and that's not just with play, that's with anything that you're teaching your dog. You have to make sure that, you know, when you're practicing, you know, in the house, you then need to take it out into your garden, and then you need to take it out step by step further away from your home until your dog can do it everywhere. And I think that is one of the things that a lot of pet dog owners don't actually do with their dogs. They don't think about the fact that we need to practice all these things that we're learning and practice them in different locations and in different places. Because they just expect that the dog will generalize everything. So, well, if it could do it in the garden, why can't he do it in the park? Because it's just all grass. Yeah. And it just doesn't work like that, because there's so much more distractions around, and you just need to build the distractions up as well as the different environments for the dog to learn that it doesn't matter where you are, this is what I want you to do in this situation.
Yeah, and it's, if you take it in a little by little process like that, it's a big word, but I use like diagnostic information. So you're taking diagnostics as to how does the dog feel in this location. So if we've gone from the park, from the back garden to the front garden, the only thing that might have changed is that in the confines, so the dog's nice and safe in the confined front garden, the thing that's changed there is that there's cars parked out the front, or there's cars moving past, or there's a person there. So if it's a person that's causing the issue, depending on how they're causing the issue, is the dog sensitive, or do they want to go over and see them? It's then possible to set a structured setup in the back garden where we gradually introduce the individual, get progress there, and then take a step forward. It sounds complicated, and it really isn't, but it makes for a much easier and clearer training plan. And progress, in my experience, is much clearer and much more fluid when you like operate in that way.
Yeah, and it's also that when you're doing it that way, you're actually setting your dog up to succeed.
Yes, for sure. That's most important.
Which is really important, because if you take your dog into an environment where they can't cope, then you're setting them up to fail. It doesn't matter what you're asking them to do. If the environment is something that they're worried about, they're not going to achieve the behaviours and the things that we want them to do there, because they just can't cope with that situation. So setting your dog up to succeed by just building step by step on the behaviour or the play, yes, or exactly whatever right. it is that you want to do, by doing that, you're setting your dog up for success. And if you find that you're struggling with something, you just take a couple of steps back.
Exactly right. That is exactly
and
right.
And then, you know, you just change things very, very slightly just to make sure that your dog can cope in that situation and can respond the way you want them to respond, and then you take it on again, don't you?
Yeah, exactly right. Then that sets everything up in success for the handler, it's success yeah. for the dog, and it makes it easy from the handler's perspective to then make any changes that are needed yeah. around the behavior. And that's play is going to yep. be a reinforcing activity, but that would be exactly the same with a sit, because yep. it's the sit is going to be dependent or concurrent on the reinforcer that comes afterwards. So yep. you've got to try to make sure that you treat the reinforcer, which is play, exactly the same way as you would do any other behavior, and build incrementally up to the target spot.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and it's I think, you know, for pet dog owners, I think this is the step that they miss quite often, is that they really think that, okay, yeah, but my dog can do it in the back garden, my dog can do it in my house, so they must be able to do it everywhere.
And it's such a big step in reality. It's like
a huge step.
And dependent on the dog that you've got as well, because yeah. for some dogs, like the genetic influence on behaviour, so what they're born with, dictates much of what they are able to do, or the behaviours yeah. that they will display as an individual. So if you've got a dog that is from 15 generations of working dog that have been bred to be extremely environmentally stable, confident, all of those traits are going to switch over. So with that type of puppy, normally, the process is much quicker. Like you take your little bit of play in the living room, you go to the back garden, and very quickly you're playing and doing that behavior in a location that is escalated. But then you may have a dog that's had some bad experiences. That doesn't make them like a problem dog. That just means that the process needs to be tailored to suit them. Or you yeah. may have a dog who hasn't got that genetic influence on behavior, and the process and the technique that you use is going to be slightly different. So they may be playing with, to begin with, like a lotus ball, which is a food ball that I use really
regularly. Have I got one lying around? I have got one lying around. Hang on a sec. Okay. I'll just grab one.
Okay.
Lotus ball. Where did I see it? There. Okay, just.
That's okay.
Yeah, just pop that back in. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So this is a lotus ball.
So we pop food in the center of that,
so
there,
you pop and
we
food in there, and mm-hmm. then you fold it up.
Just one at a time, though, to start with. So you just close.
Yeah. So one so you have that open. You just do that to start off with.
Uh huh.
And then the next stage is you bring the other one in.
That's it.
And then the other one. And before you know it, your dog is actually pushing in the middle.
That's exactly
to get the
right.
food, opening it up by itself and eating the food that's in the middle.
That's it. That's exactly right. And then we build towards them chasing that and doing that at a distance with confidence of their own yeah. accord. So it may be the case that that is the style of play that we're using with that dog to begin with. And then later on, we tie an extension to that lotus ball and we get them chasing that. They bite onto that. And that's where the tuggy comes from. But that process may be far different to a dog that is at 5 weeks old biting onto trouser legs and trying to pull your socks off of you, because those dogs, it's going to be easy to get them to play and bite with yeah. other items and use that as an alternative behaviour for them biting onto your trousers. So yeah. it's different for every dog. And I would say to everybody that just to consider the unique traits of your dog as an individual. And just because, you know, maybe one of your friends or people in your peer groups have dogs that are doing this in this particular way, just because your dog isn't necessarily doing it in said way, that doesn't make that a negative. All it means is that we have to think as trainers, caregivers, guardians, to try to make sure that we tailor the reinforcement process to suit them. And that's most important. That's one of the big takeaways from today's podcast, I would say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You always have to adjust what you're doing to the dog that you're training.
Exactly right.
The dog that you're playing with. And When you're doing that, you know, also bear in mind that if your dog's doing it at home, it doesn't necessarily mean that it can do it in the park straight away. You'll have to build up to that. Mm-hmm. I think that is the. I think those two are the most important things from, you know, to take away from this podcast.
Yeah, definitely. For sure. And if people have got like specific questions on play or how they might go about it, you can obviously, if you see Natasha regularly, you can ask her because she'll be able to implement many of my techniques. But you're always welcome to message me because I'm on like Instagram, you can contact me, or on Facebook, because there's always going to be just a little thing that we need to change or twist around.
Yeah,
that will produce the result and give you the key into the door. And it may be the case that you can take the information, the choice to chase, the implementing the tuggy little by little, and then slowly generalizing the behavior to different locations from today's podcast. But if you're struggling a little bit, all you've got to do, and I promise I will get back to you, is just drop me a message, ask for a little bit of information, and then we can
make and guys, he's really good at doing that.
I try my best.
Yes, yeah, you're really good at doing that, actually. But thank you very much for coming on, Craig.
So, you're very welcome.
Yeah. Do you want to just sort of tell people exactly, you know, your website address and
Instagram
handles and things like that?
The easiest way to get hold of me is on Instagram, which is Craig Ogilvie Dog Training. If you just DM me on there, I'll get back to you as soon as I possibly can do. Facebook as well, Craig Ogilvie Dog Training. You can message me on there. And the website is www.craigogilviedogtraining.com. And there's information on there of how to email through. So I'll be able to get back to you via there as well. So I'm always happy to help, guys. If you want to get in contact, please do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast, Craig.
You're very welcome.
And we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think I'm doing an instructor's course for you soon. So,
yes, the 9th. So it's
28th today.
It's 28th today. So it's like, well, it's on the 9th, isn't it? So
yes, nearly a couple of weeks.
Yeah, just under a couple of weeks. Not quite.
I look forward to seeing you then, Natasha. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you so much for listening in. I hope you found it beneficial.